Welcome back to Deprogrammed. This is the New Culture Forum show committed to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be rejoined this week by Evan Riggs, who is a freelance journalist and is now back in action in the mother country after a brief sojourn in the New World. And our special guest this week, Samuel Martin, editor-in-chief of The Mallard, a socially and culturally conservative magazine. Now, Sam, quick one to begin with. Are you encouraged by the recent defection of Lee Anderson from the Tories to Reform?
Not especially. This is not to say that I think that Anderson should have remained with the Tories. Rather, I think that it is a sign that Reform is increasingly becoming a recycling unit for the political establishment. Mm. I think that first off in Rochdale, they reused a Labour MP who lost, and Lee Anderson, who has gone from being part of one of the most inert governments in British history to a most likely ex-MP. I don't think that Lee Anderson's defection will mean much for the right. It very much feels as though that the Reform UK is aligning itself to be a solution, not to the disaffection of the country, to the British people, but rather an attempt to resolve a factional dispute within the parliamentary party, the Parliamentary Conservative Party, which, knowing what we do about Westminster, is hardly ideologically and politically aligned with the rest of the country.
So in functional terms, it is more or less indistinguishable from, for example, the European Research Group in the Conservative Party, which existed and put lots of pressure on Theresa May in like 2017, 2018. The difference there being that it was actually formally part of the party. That doesn't apply in this case, but nevertheless, there is still a kind of, there's a ragged boundary between Reform and the right of the Tory party. And as such, it makes it difficult for Reform to distinguish itself and to actually pose a real direct challenge to potentially replace the Conservative Party. You don't see that as potentially taking place?
Well, I think that I've spoken about this for several years, as have many others, which is that there is certainly a benefit to having a smaller right-leaning party to put pressure on the Conservatives from the outside, because admittedly, there's only so much that you can do from the back benches. However, I think that the way that Reform is pitching itself, we saw what Farage said after the PopCon event, which was essentially, well, there are a lot of people here that believe what we believe in Reform UK. It's like, well, hang on a minute. We know for a fact that popular conservatism isn't particularly popular. I know that's pretty cliche, but we know it to be true. There is no excitement for Orange Book liberalism wrapped in a Union Jack. We don't really need another brand of Thatcherism trying to mutate into something relevant. We are in, I think, new waters now, and we require new captains, we require new lieutenants and so on and so forth. This constant shifting about chairs on the Titanic, I really don't think is going to help much. And as such, I don't think that a member of the Tory party moving to the Reform party, even if fringe parties or outrider parties, like as a general concept or a general practice, can be good, I don't think that Reform is going to make the impact that it could have on the upcoming general election. And I certainly don't think that Lee Anderson's defection, as the circumstances of defection were quite poor. I think that the Tories and also the right-leaning press could have done a better job at defending him.
After his comments on...
I think that they could have done a far better job of that. The general consensus, the silent consensus amongst much of the right was effectively, well, Lee Anderson is, his words were clumsy and
intemperate.
Anti-intellectual and, and a little bit crass crass and vulgar. What he meant to say was, I think that this is, at this point, it's like,
it's not good enough.
Are we actually a political movement, or are we just the tone police? Just to revert back to your question. I don't think that, parties that ride to the right of the Conservative Party can absolutely have an influence. But only when they're actually to the right of the Conservative Party and not defining themselves on a very narrow, what seems to be a very narrow and technical issue.
Do you think it actually makes Reform look kind of weak, that basically the biggest announcement that they can give is that they're a safety net for people who get booted out of the Tories?
I think that that's a massive drawback. I think that if you want to pitch yourself as like a party that's actually going to, if Reform is what it says, because, you know, they went and they rebranded themselves as Reform, the Brexit Party, it's like, hey, remember us? They seem to want to, even if they're doing the political activities under a different name, they still very much want to retain the spirit of what they were doing in the 2019 European elections, which was the idea of, we're going to change politics for good, we're going to fully upend the establishment. And now it's like, we are, as you say, like the safety net for Tory MPs who, you know, again, admittedly, bad circumstances, bad treatment, aren't actually producing a roster of candidates and policies, which is, as their slogan goes, as is supposedly the essence of their movement, to change politics for good.
But is it not the case, and so what you say is very well taken, but is it not the case, precisely because Reform has set itself up as a separate legal and corporate and political entity from the Conservative Party, and you're saying that that's only really like a de jure thing, de facto, it's more of a sort of recycling plant, and there is certainly some truth to that. But is it not possible that Reform could nevertheless, they're not necessarily going to make any kind of sufficient achievement, but they might perform the necessary function at this point in British history, at least, of just completely cleansing the Tory Party. And what I mean by that is this: like, the problem is that the Conservative Party at the moment is such a sort of ragtag of different factions and interests.
They're united by one issue that has in large part depleted in relevance.
Well, what was that issue? You mean the hatred of the Labour Party?
Two issues then.
Which one were you thinking?
Because I was thinking of Brexit.
Of course,
the idea was like, we're going to try and gather together as many people who support Brexit and get it over a line. Great, now that's done. Yes. And start betraying the revolution.
I see what you mean. Of course, that alignment was which occurred in 2019 has certainly been like completely wasted. But nevertheless, there are still these hangers-on in the Conservative Party. I don't even know how many people in the Conservative Party I would regard as sort of authentically Conservative. But what I'm basically saying is that because let's just say I roughly 80% of them would probably be better off ideologically in the Lib Dems. If Reform can just put a stake through the heart of the Conservative Party, it is sufficiently disliked by people like Penny Mordaunt. For them not to, it's not like Penny Mordaunt is going to find herself in Reform. They might nevertheless peel off that sort of 15-20% of sound Conservative MPs who would come into Reform and would consolidate that Conservatism in Reform, and they would replace the Conservative Party, and all of these people in the Conservative Party who had regarded that as the place to be would all of a sudden have to defect to the Lib Dems, and no one would vote for them.
Of course, I mean, like, you can say that. You know, even if they don't provide a fatal blow, or they don't provide a particularly groundbreaking change, or if they don't provide, if they don't apply a sufficient degree of damage, at least they are doing some form of political damage.
Indeed.
I
think will have a clarifying effect. I didn't mean cleansing so much as clarifying.
Like, yes.
People would have to say that this is where I stand, and they'd no longer be able to feign a conservative attitudes within a party that calls itself the Conservative Party. That if the Conservative Party is killed off and Reform is effectively there to replace it as the sort of the new representative of the right in British politics, like, because Farage is at the head of it, Penny Mordaunt and all of the Wets and Pinkos are not going to join Reform. They'll have nowhere else to go. Whereas that 20% spearheaded by people like Lee Anderson may be able to come into Reform, and then people like us would feel as though we had more, not perfect, because Reform isn't perfect, but would feel as though, and we can maybe get into ideologically ways in which they're not completely sound, but we would have much more in the way of representation at Westminster.
I think the representation in Westminster, at the very least, it can definitely send a message, I think this ties nicely into what you said about ideology, which is that, is it going to send the right message, or is it going to send a message that is going to be contaminated somewhat? Despite their loss in Rochdale, the Reform Party seems to be, Reform UK, seems to be still riding on this idea that we need to destroy the con-socialists, and we need to defeat anti-Semitism, and we can't have socialism in this country, and whatever. And it's like, like if the like message from that, like it's just, it's quite easy for a message, a message that is sent by voting reform can just as easily be taken, oh, we the Conservative Party have not done enough on tackling anti-Semitism. We haven't done enough. We haven't done enough free marketeering. Why, maybe we do need to listen to Liz Truss. It's like no, like most people vote reform because they're hoping that you'll understand that people do not want mass immigration.
Yeah, well, I was off in the New World. I watched Rishi Sunak's speech outside of number 10, and I was, well, it was abysmal. But I, you know, I was thinking while I was watching, I was like, who do I know of in UK politics and in any party would deliver a different speech than this? And different in the way that we would prefer it, as opposed to just being worse. You know, where he comes out and he says, we need to work against anti-Islamism or Islamophobia, as well as, you know, far-right ideology. It's like, who is not going to have this kind of both-sidism approach to things? It's like recently there was £117 million
Something like that, yeah.
Given out to increase, you know, the security of, you know, mosques and Muslims. And it was like, from who? Where is this threat coming from? Like this, like, I don't even think it was as much, I think it was more than the amount that was given out to Jewish communities in the UK, which are actually under threat.
Well, the sheer fact that we see, despite the fact that there are many mosques in this country, or at any rate, many more mosques than used to exist in this country today, like, there are plenty of places for Muslims to worship, and yet in many cases they nevertheless insist on worshiping in very public places. So the idea that Islam in this country, still less political Islam, is a sort of coward, terrified force, rather than in fact one which feels incredibly emboldened and feels incredibly triumphalist, is way off base. And I think what you said is completely spot on. Like, there is this sort of very effectively politically correct cult of both sidesism, as you put it, like this sort of cult of even-handedness. I can't seem to be castigating one threat to democracy in this country. I need to make myself seem like a sensible centrist and make it clear that, oh, of course, while it goes without saying that the far right is also a tremendous threat to this country.
Yeah, and all 600 of them.
All 600 of them, yeah. And also like terribly defined. Like, it's not like no one will ever. Like we saw recently with the Shawcross report, didn't we? The Shawcross report into many of Prevent's activities, the Prevent being the counterterrorism unit in this country, were sort of as sort of potential signs of far-right activism, were like reading Tolkien and reading Locke's Second Treatise of Government.
Being anti-abortion was one of them.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, this general trend seems to have been, you know, even if it hasn't existed in legal structures until relatively recently, these kinds of incidents have occurred throughout you know, contemporary British history, at least, very least sort of like during the sort of the post-Blair years. I can't remember which university it was, but a couple of years ago, there was a university hosted a society called, I think it was called the Nietzsche Club, and it was literally just dedicated to reading about Friedrich Nietzsche. That got shut down for being far right.
Yeah, that's a hotbed right there.
It's a hotbed of far right extremism. You know, it's like, you know, if ever my five needs a casus belli to, you know, arrest me, I will confess that I do occasionally read Aristotle. Yeah. I do occasionally take a gander into Thomas Carlyle and Wyndham Lewis.
But there's something incredibly schizophrenic about it as well, because on the one hand, every single MP, with potentially some honourable exceptions, many of them probably in the DUP, and maybe one or two in the Conservative Party, would assent to the proposition that diversity is our strength. And yet at the same time, there is this implicit concession that community relations are in fact a very volatile thing. They constantly exist on a knife's edge. And as Rishi Sunak put it in that sort of anti-extremism speech, it's precisely in order to hold together the ragged tapestry, he didn't use that word, that's my word, but the ragged tapestry of multicultural Britain, that we need I think what he called a new comprehensive anti-extremism network. That if diversity really is a strength, it wouldn't need a formidable battery of legal reinforcements to make it work. And so there is such a sort of chronic schizophrenia to the way in which we talk about this, and it's partly served by this cult of even-handedness, this cult of both-sidesism, whereby the Conservative Party feels as though it needs to put basically our vindictive colonizers and the people who resent their presence here on a level playing field with one another, and say that they both jointly pose a threat to democracy.
I do wonder, though, to kind of steel man Rishi's position, not that he really deserves it, is like, I wonder if when you're writing a speech like that, like you speak to like counterterrorism experts or whatever in the government, and they say basically, look, if things keep going at this rate, you know, we have like a 30% chance of like a Bataclan or a Manchester Arena or something like that. Like they can just like scare the shit out of you. Because there is a real threat where if you don't do that kind of both sides, I mean, if you just give the money to the Jews and you don't also give some to Muslims or whatever, there could be a legitimate attack. And so we're forced into this paradigm under the ever-present sort of Damocles hanging above our heads of like, if we don't kind of, you know, try to at least, I don't know, if we don't see to at least trying to be fair, basically there will be another spate of serious incidences.
And it's a mistaken calculation, but yes, I'm sure psychologically that's probably what's operative at that.
I think we don't talk about this a lot on the right, which is like, you know, the things that a lot of people say need to be done, you know, in our kind of side of the aisle, if they were actually enacted, there would be a lot of terror attacks in this country and in Europe. Like, I don't think there's any way around that. And I don't think anybody's even ready to have that conversation because we have no idea what would be done to address them. It would just be like an intense acceleration effect.
We have this weird paradox in Britain where effectively, in the name of social cohesion, we are arresting and censoring people for calling out things which are destroying social cohesion. You know, we are arresting people and throwing them in prison and censoring them and getting kicked out of their jobs for saying, you know, hey, I think that, you know, there might be a lot of like, you know, a lot of rape of young white girls across the country by South Asian men. Like, is no one noticing this pattern? Is no one noticing? And you know, say we can't do that. So it's, you know, so social cohesion. It's like, I'm pretty sure that we're past the mark if like we're dealing with this, like, you know, up and down the country.
They see themselves as past the point of preventing this, and at the point where all that can really be done is to manage this incredibly, precarious modus vivendi that exists between different communities. The point I'm making, and the funny thing about that is that they will, either the other side of their mouth, proclaim that diversity is our greatest strength when it is the cause of a lot of this stuff. And there's also the point to be made that like practically none of what passes for far-right activism, as far as like people like Rishi Sunak are concerned, would even exist without this initial active portrayal in the first place. Because one of the most treacherous things that Rishi Sunak said in the course of that speech, and I think I brought it with me, like he talked about how both the far-right and Islamists pose a joint threat to the modern multicultural Britain that we are, as he put it, we are building together. No one was ever asked if they wanted to engage in this quixotic project of trying to be one of the first, trying to be the first country in history to build a peaceful and cohesive multicultural utopia.
I would love to hear him explain what he means by that. Like, why do Muslims specifically pose a threat to multiculturalism in the UK?
Presumably, well, I mean,
what would the explanation be?
I was about to take your question literally. but it's a problem, and I also think there's something particularly sinister about it. And because I mean, the whole, like, surely in order to integrate into this country, a bare minimum of integrating this country as a second or third generation immigrant or whatever Rishi Sunak is not to impose like a propagandistic form of settler colonialism onto the host population into which you're supposedly integrating. And if you're saying that we are engaged in building a multicultural project together and you're completely riding roughshod over the national self-determination rights of the host in deciding whether they actually wanted to do that, which obviously they didn't, that to me is not a sign that you've integrated very well. Even if you did go to Winchester,
did you see that there was a clip circulating around X, formerly Twitter, where I think it was two Muslim guys saying like, you know, they're always pushing the British values, and it's like, oh, this is a two way. There's a two way street to this, and that you guys don't really like this either. You came here, and then it was like, surprise, we're building multiculturalism. We're all going to be like libtards. And it's like, what? I came here because other Pakistanis were here. What the hell is going on?
I think the same clip was literally like these two guys are speaking like, I hate them, but I can live alongside them. Like, even though I hate them, I can find it within me to live next to you.
That's
But that they're saying that as like, it's like the epitome of tolerance. Like, I've lived in a lot of countries I was not a citizen of, and if I hated the people around me, I left.
Exactly.
Aristotle says friendship is the basis of the polis, and that does not sound like friendship at all. We are effectively sacrificing natural solidarity as a basis for the state with basically top-down, you know, control, effectively, yes, and social engineering and so on.
And on the part of new immigrant communities, so sort of, as I've been saying, like a kind of like self-restrained enmity, like I really don't like them, but I can just about refrain.
I can just about not grab them by the neck and kill them.
It's like, can you imagine like if you were gonna like try to empathize with somebody like that, like if you were gonna emigrate somewhere and literally you're on the plane, you're like flying there and you're like, I fucking hate these people. do you know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna like survive this, well, this is, but like, I really don't like where I'm going. It's, that's weird.
It's so bizarre.
That would warp you.
It's so, so bizarre. And the only circumstance in which I can envision myself thinking that is just not how I think at all, really. I'm pleased to report, but as if I need that, yeah, I need to get that in there. But I think as well, it has a lot to do with the difference between immigrating as an individual, and this is sort of what you've both been touching on, and immigrating into a pre-existing diaspora which already exists in a place. So, like, for example, if there was a huge, effectively a huge settler colony, like de facto settler colony of English people living in, I don't know, Japan, it is possible that because I would probably double down on my Britishness because I would be living, because I would feel the contrast day to day between like the little district of Tokyo in which I lived as an Englishman among lots of other Englishmen and the contrast with the Japanese. And it's possible that I might, I don't know, let's not make this autobiographical. It's possible that an English person might feel a weird kind of, grudge against the Japanese because of the Second World War, or like whatever it might be. And it's possible that resentments could intermingle in that settler colony. And since that lots of these people do not immigrate as individuals, and then therefore they don't feel that instinctive pressure to integrate as they would if they had immigrated as individuals, they basically join the various settler colonies that we have, whether in Birmingham, whether in Blackburn, and all the rest of it. And so I think that partly accounts for why friendship it doesn't even enter into consideration, or rather the friendship is directed at their own diaspora rather than at Britain as a whole.
Yes, and I'm glad that you brought up the issue of historical grievance, because whilst that is absolutely a source of volatility, so, you know, as we saw in places like Leicester, where these things just seem to like boil over from nowhere, it's not even exclusively that. I mean, you can understand people who, I think there's an assumption amongst the ruling class that, like, despite what might feel like day-to-day an absolute obsession with identity and identity politics and all these sorts of things, there is still a weird assumption that people who are coming to the country will just happily give up their entire ancestry for, like, a little bit of paper that says you're a citizen.
Indeed.
and that just seems incredibly, like, you know,
inhumane.
Right, and you know, and I don't say that in like a soppy humanitarian way. I say that more in a, these people don't actually, like, these people are in a little, like, you know, they have their own sense of who they are, and they do not, and, you know, London being one of the most provincial and insular places in the country, I believe that, by the way,
yes,
you know, as most cosmopolitan areas are, there is a broad assumption that, you know, the archaic concept of, like, of ethnic and cultural identity simply would not resonate, despite also paradoxically it being the basis for the multicultural Britain for which we are building. So it's like, so are these just, like, is religion, like, you know, religion and all these other things are meant to just be empty signifiers? They're meant to adorn nicely the public spaces, but no one is actually allowed to hold them in any, is not allowed to necessarily revere them or act on them or affect, or they're not allowed to become political in any way, which, again, like, is not going to happen. Like, you can't realistically expect to have a society where every single religion under the sun is celebrated and is revered and, you know, is encouraged and tolerated. And at the same time, you impose, like, you know, liberal secularism on everyone and expect, well, hang on a minute, am I just meant to have religion as, like, this nice little quaint thing
in private life?
In private life, or is am I not allowed to affect change in the world in accordance with my moral principles?
Indeed.
But also on the, I veered off there slightly, but on the historical grievance front, it doesn't even matter if it's historical. Like, people want to be different. People want to be themselves. They want to feel as though that they have a place in the universe that gives them a sense of ground, of rootedness, of groundedness. So I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a scene from The Sopranos where Tony Soprano's going off on a basically explain to his therapist, like, you know, say, like, you Americans, when you brought us here for cheap labor, and you said that you're going to be an American now. Well, guess what? Some of us wanted to remain Italian, and it's like that's like so. You might say, oh, the historical grievance between, you know, like assuming like well, it is assuming that America is a like an, essentially at least nominally or like a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country.
Originally, yeah.
Yes, originally. We wouldn't assume that, you know, we wouldn't say, okay, like, you know, like England, America, Italy, they had, like, you know, I can't think of any, like, real sort of, like, blood feud which exists between Englishmen or Americans and Italians now. But this specific gripe exists amongst the Italian-descended population and the wider American population. And it's not a historical thing, but it is more just a sense of, I want to be me.
It's a function of the fact that, like, human beings cleave to their identity. And so even if there is not, as you say, even if there is not a, like, any kind of particularly historicized ancestral grudge between Group A and Group B, nevertheless, making Group A live in close proximity to Group B, those grudges are likely to develop.
I'm also reminded of the scene in The Sopranos where the Italian-American mobsters go back to Italy and all the Italians hate their guts because they just think they're Americans.
Yeah.
It's like, at a certain point, like, you can't go back.
That is true.
But, you know, I think it's interesting on the sort of, everybody who wants to come here wants to become a part of Britain. It's like, first of all, it's evidently not true now, but it's also not true in any country that I'm aware of at any point in history that, like, we'll use Italy and the UK, for example. It's not like a bunch of Italians ever went to the UK and were like, oh, this is obviously much better than our thing. Why don't we just make our country more like this? That's never happened. Everybody wants to be individualized, and that's a good thing. I mean, that's like actual diversity in like a non cliche way, but like in a good way.
It's almost as if we should recognize our right to difference, to borrow a term.
indeed. No, I agree with you, Samuel. But if we're getting back to, I suppose, like, solutions to this problem, we're not encouraged by reform. We've got an election coming up this year. I doubt it will be in May. I think it will be actually in very close proximity to the American election, which will make it a particularly interesting autumn.
Very fun.
I mean, so what do we want? What do you want reform to achieve in that election, if anything? What do you want to happen, and how do you see the post 2024 fallout developing on the right?
I think that, like, you know, if the thing that reform really should do is basically, like, get a better graphic designer for one, put, you know, the con socialism jibes on the back burner, put the anti-Semitism, like, you know, patrol
on
away.
On the back burner suggests they're going to wheel them out again. I think in the trash is what you mean.
We have to be pragmatic. We want to win, don't we?
But that's true.
Yes, I think that they should. Really, like, any, like, I think it's good that you know, minor parties or fringe parties aspire to be something other than a one issue force. I think that's what made UKIP in 2015 such like, you know, a success. I mean, yeah, they didn't win a seat, but
Was it fair to say that UKIP in 2015 aspired to be more than a single issue party?
They absolutely did. Like, I mean, they had, like, the way that I guess you could, like, visualize it is that they had, you know, they had the wheel, and in the middle they had their commitment to leave the European Union. But around that they had things like cutting foreign aid, basically reforming the NHS, all these other things.
So you're contrasting UKIP in 2015 with, say, its origins in the Bruges Group in the 90s, where it really was just European.
Yes, it was very much a case of, you know, they maintained their commitment to leaving the European Union, but they had various other things on the side. There was, like, you know, there was, like, various, like, you could go to, like, UKIP 2015 manifesto, and there was stuff in there about, like, animal rights, healthcare, foreign aid, economy.
But the thing that makes, you are right, they obviously had a manifesto they had to do, and, like, Suzanne Evans was a big part of, like, spearheading that. And so, you know, there was that in 2015, but nevertheless, I'd argue that reform has gone even further than that, because, like, implicit in the existence of UKIP was the idea that once we've achieved that central plank of our, like, raison d'etre, namely leaving the European Union, will sort of they didn't say that. They, like, the implicit understanding was, and this is proved by the fact that you Nigel Farage summarily left UKIP after 2016, is that we would cease to exist, that our raison d'etre would be gone. Whereas in Reform, there seems to be an understanding that we're not just here to try and scourge the Tories into reforming themselves, we're actually here to try and replace them.
As I recall it, Farage, when he was running for the leadership of UKIP, basically said, we shouldn't be a single issue party, even if this is absolutely our namesake, right? This is our namesake policy.
I'm agreeing with you, but what I'm saying is that I think Reform have taken that commitment to be something other than a single issue party a step further, in that there is not that implicit understanding in Reform that they will pack up as soon as they've achieved.
That's true.
They want to replace the Conservative Party in the same way that the Labour Party replaced the Liberals in the early decades of the last century. And I think I share all of your. Maybe we should get into it a little bit before talking too much about what's going. Like, can you explain why you? I couldn't agree with you more. But can you explain why you don't like the term consocialist and to our viewers?
Oh, because I think that, well, I don't consider myself a socialist, but I will say that the fixation with socialism, I think, is a very, very American thing. I think that people, generally speaking, have a, I guess, sort of softer interpretation of socialism in Britain. I'm not saying that people are rabidly anti-capitalist. Like, I think from what I've seen and what I've read and polls that have been done, people seem to have, like, I wouldn't say that they're anti-capitalist and they're anti-socialist, but rather they just don't have a, they have a very vague idea of, well, we need another a fundamentally different economic system, but they don't really see it in either of the prevailing economic ideologies which you know have defined modernity. And the thing is that you actually see this in both the right and the left, and especially the left, because when you come across leftist activists and when you see them online, they don't actually characterize themselves as socialists or communists anymore. They're always anti-capitalist, it's an entirely negativistic bent to their political philosophy. And it's a general sense of I want things to change, I want things to be different, but I've been so embedded in, like, the idea that capitalism is just this omnipresent thing that is inert and will not go away and will just remain with us seems to afflict even its most it's the most vicious enemies of its existence.
There's also I agree with you, and I think there's also it helps induce the complacent belief that we're still up against people like Michael Foot when we're clearly not. There is a new species of radical in town.
That too.
And our gun should be aimed on that, not on these sort of museum pieces.
Do you recall the Brexit Party manifesto? Do you remember that absolute keynote?
In 2019?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No, is the answer.
I can't list every single policy off the top of my head, but I can absolutely send you it. And it was there were some things in there where it's this has obviously survived to the Reform Party. These things have just always been kicking around as certain issues. But it's they were promising the Brexit dividend.
Oh yeah.
They were basically promising control of fisheries. And it's this is effectively to coin a phrase, this is National Socialism. this is effectively this is a very, despite saying classically liberal on the tin, it was quite dirigist in its economic proposals. But even if over all of that was just the general commitment of, we want to get out of the European Union.
Yeah, well, I suppose the basic point being is that what we need is not so much a revival of the late 1970s and early 1980s, an economic liberalization form of medicine. We need something much more akin to a national renewal, and issues like immigration, the sort of cultural issues that we talk about on the New Culture Forum, should always be prior to any kind of economic obsessions that agenda. And Thijs, who I think is a well-meaning man, and I don't have any particularly personal hostility towards him. He just doesn't seem to me to be fit for the moment in which we find ourselves.
Yes, that's true.
I think Curtis Yarvin once said that you can tell how right-wing an organization is by how bad their graphic design is. But the problem is in the UK, and especially with Reform, it's not due to them being actually right-wing, it's just sheer incompetence. And it does inspire a lot of hope.
And there's also, and I don't know whether this has to do with the fact that Thijs is a business, I think he's made a lot of money in the city or something like that. It has an incredibly soulless corporate feel to it. It's sort of, like, if you were to look at their graphics, like, quite apart from the content, if you were to look at their graphics, you could be forgiven for thinking that all these people really think we need is just a little bit of tinkering here, a little bit of tinkering there. Like, it doesn't sort of
turn the dials.
Turn the dial. It doesn't strike,
you know, slide things up and down.
Indeed,
it's
indeed.
Like, you know, it's just like a nice and
streamline.
And yeah. The thing is that it's interesting that you say that, because we would not consider. Most people, I don't think, would, well, as I said before, like this party on the tin says that we are classically liberal, but most people would not consider that to be the Reform part of Reform UK to be a post-liberal party. Most people wouldn't associate that, but that is kind of what they're doing, because post-liberalism as a general school of thought is the belief that, well, it doesn't actually fundamentally challenge the assumptions of a liberal capitalist democracy. It really just seeks to rebalance the political system within the Overton window.
Yes.
I don't know if you know this, but there was a pamphlet produced by David Goodhart, who wrote an article in the Times recently about how diversity is causing a whole array of problems, which is largely true.
He's noticed, has he?
Yes, he's noticed. Well, actually, he's noticed for a while, because in 2006 he wrote a pamphlet called Progressive Nationalism, and he basically said that, like, look, one of the things, like, there is a growing sense of nationalism, and I guess you'd call it there are reactionary forces at play. We, on both the centre right and the centre left, need to construct an ideology or a political model which can offer belonging, which can offer a degree of security and otherwise, otherwise globalised liberal capitalist society. And so, you know, there is a degree to which you can look at the tactics like Reform and go, is this, like, is this containment? Because that's what it seems like from time to time. Because, you know, I, like, Reform does, like, yeah, they do talk about, like, the small boats and this sort of thing. They do, like, occasionally chime in on, like, you know, how immigration is just, how the Tories have failed to deal with immigration. But again, these things tend to be juggling the issues rather than this is the centerpiece and these are the different aspects around it. We're going to turn our political movement around this. We're going to drive it over the structure that exists currently, because we genuinely believe that the political system is out of date, or at the very least, it doesn't serve the interests of the people.
And I think you can have some supply side, if you really must. You can throw in some supply side reforms.
Oh, of course, you can
into the mix as well if you like. And but, like, the problem is the way in which Tice leads with them, and, like, that is not, like, if the Reform really want to get into, like, the sort of SDP territory, like in the 1983 election where like Michael Foot had a serious challenge to his right, and Thatcher had a serious challenge to her left, and the SDP nearly did quite well in that election. If you want to get into the 20s and start winning by-elections, I do think that you need to stop this talk of consocialism. Stop acting like we're facing a revival of the post-war consensus. Stop only talking about tax cuts. Your primary focuses should be like immigration and DEI across
institutions. And the point that I'm just making there is that after that, once it's established that you do actually need that sort of central, you need that central focus, you've also got to then go, okay, then, is this, like, in detail, is this actually what we want? Because most people would look at the proposals and things like Goodhart's Progressive Nationalism and go, this isn't exactly what people believe when it comes to reducing diversity. This just seems to me like the status quo, where you try to bind an increasingly diverse and multicultural society by effectively imposing liberal values from the top down.
A new narrative.
Like, you know, imposing some sort of welfare chauvinism here and there. Greatly emphasizing the ownership of British citizenship as if we said, like, it's very difficult to substitute blood for paper, whether that be a little passport or money, or, like, you know, I think a lot of people seem to think that they can just hold together society based on economic development. I think it's a completely wrong thing to do.
It is interesting to me that Reform, and mainly Reform, doesn't seem to have learned the biggest lesson of politics of the last 10 years, which is that people are not comfortable just voting against things anymore.
Yes.
You need to give people something to vote for. Like, people voted for UKIP because they're voting for Brexit. People will even vote for the SDP because they like the SDP's policies.
Oh, absolutely.
Nobody's voting for Reform because they like Reform. They're just voting for them because they hate the Tories. Mm. But that's not actually good enough.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they could possibly do, or what anybody in UK politics could possibly do at this point, to give someone something to vote for. And until somebody kind of like cuts through that Gordian knot, I think we're going to be talking about the same thing on this podcast week after week.
I think that the negativistic problem, I think that also exists on the right. But I would also add to that that when we are dealing with issues of, you know, will reform do well? Will reform, like, you know, hoover up votes on the Tories? I think there's like a very non-zero chance, like 50-50, that the next election is basically 2001 2.0, where you have a large Labour landslide, but turnout basically plummets because the conclusion is foretold. And whilst you do have, whilst like minor parties might gain here and there, like the bulk of like right-wing voters just kind of like stay home because they don't know that reform like exists, and if they do, they might not be tantalized by it. Like the recent by-elections again don't seem to be doing much favors for them in terms of like, you know, presenting themselves as like a
credible alternative.
As a force with momentum behind it. I think that negativistically there are, for that exact reason, I think that you're actually going to see a large drop in participation at the next election. And I think actually that might be a more effective message than actually voting for reform. Because it's you're not voting for something, but at the very least, it's like, I would rather make it my intentions absolutely clear that I want absolutely nothing to do with the way that politics is currently operating, rather than cast my vote for a party that really has some, like, you know, is not really doing what I think most like right-leaning conservative individuals want or want them to focus on.
I definitely agree. I agree with what both of you I agree with what both of you have said there. It seems to me, though, that precisely because we do not have a political vehicle in this country yet, for our sort of political philosophy to be carried through, whether couched in negativistic terms or whether couched in positive terms, it seems to me that for the moment our main priority should be doing our best to bring about precisely what Peter Hitchens thought needed to happen in 2010, namely the sort of the irreversible destruction of the Conservative Party.
Yes, bring it, like cutting off the regime's right arm.
Yes. And hoping it can
grow. Amputating it so then we can get something to punch the Leviathan in the face.
Indeed, hoping we can grow a bionic one, we can graft a bionic one onto it as well. So it seems to me that just needs to happen. Like the precondition for any kind of national renewal is surely for the Conservative Party to cease existing, because even though Labour will, across some metrics, potentially be worse in terms of like what they're actually doing, it may have more of a radicalizing effect, because it's much more radicalizing to be stabbed relentlessly in the front than to be slowly euthanized. And like the Tory Party has been slowly euthanizing us for 40
years. And the blackpilling thing is just like, they could be like going towards like a cat, like, you know, say, oh, the Tories on Sunak needs to change course, there's a catastrophe incoming. It's like, they still might get like 150 seats. Mm-hmm. Like that's like, it's like, oh, we've got a mountain to climb here. Like they can literally like do the exact opposite of what they said they were going to do, and then some, and still they like have like a sizable number of MPs in Parliament. They still have a sizable like base of support. I think that reform is like one of several means to basically chipping away at the Tories' monopoly on the right. But I don't think it has much more purpose than that. And I think that even then, actually going out and supporting and campaigning is conditional on a lot of local politics, you know, because some places will be more inclined to vote reform, but other places will it push through? Probably not.
I think we often kind of take it as axiomatic that if the Tories were to be completely obliterated, something would rise from the ashes. And while I would like to think that's true, I don't know. I was thinking about it again in America, and I was like, there's not actually any guarantee of that happening.
Definitely not.
You might just salt the earth, and that literally nobody can pull together like a proper response in the coming years. I think there are people interested in doing it, but maybe it was just like a rare black pill moment for myself. I was like, there's no actual guarantee that like a new kind of answer to the question everybody's asking is like, what are we actually for, will actually arise. And I wonder what the UK would look like if the Tories get obliterated at the next election, and then for like 2 or 3 years, nobody really steps up to the plate.
Starmageddon.
But like, no, I mean, you know, we had Peter Hitchens in here, and I think it's actually very irresponsible for him to say people should leave, especially because he wouldn't answer the question to where. But I do think that if that happened, people would flee in like in a large way. Like if you don't have a proper response, like almost immediately, I think people will just get up and go.
I hate defeatism. I hate the blackpilling propaganda from a lot, like the doomerism from large sections of the right. Like, can you imagine like Alfred the Great, sort of like you know, after he's lost a major battle, he's sort of like walking over huddled to like the marshes of like Wessex or wherever. You know, he sits down huddling, he burns someone's cakes, and he goes, "Oh, it's over. I'm gonna have to move to Crimea to get like Slav trad wife." It's like, shut up. You're gonna be king of England, and you're gonna form the greatest country on earth. Deal with it. Like, I really don't think that we need any more, especially considering the fact that, you know, telling people to leave, okay, where? It's like, am I going to go to, like, France? Well, they're in great shape, aren't they? It's not like they're dealing with many of the great systematic problems that we've got here. Mm. Not at all.
I don't know. I guess I was contrasting it to America, because I think in America, with the American mentality and how things are going over there, if you did have like a Tory wipeout, somebody would jump in.
There's a
there.
Can-do startup spirit.
So yeah. Yes. And here, I don't like the doomerism either, but I was thinking, it's like, I think, you know, maybe if you went like kind of a year, 2 years, because it's pretty bad already here.
Yes.
People
are
like, I want to leave. If you wait too long, if somebody doesn't seize that opportunity, I do think people will just be like, ah, fuck it, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, and that point can't be stressed enough. There's nothing axiomatic about like the obliteration of the Tory party being followed by a kind of, you know, like a positive movement with national renewal. There's nothing guaranteed about that, which is why I said like it should be like that, why I phrase it as a sort of a precondition for national renewal rather than a guarantee of national renewal.
On this issue, of the lack of, like, you know, well, the lack of what you might call natural successors to the Tory party. Mm. I mean, you have Reform, but they are like, let's face it, we consider them one of several, I think most people consider them one of several options, and, you know, but isn't this also downstream from like two things? The first is that who do we have on the right in Britain that could broadly be described as a natural leader or a good public speaker or someone who is charismatic or can actually build a movement around them? And second, you know, are many like right-leaning British people who've got money willing to put money behind such a movement? Because, like, I think there's a weird tendency I see amongst a lot of like very I guess you might sort of like well-paid, very influential sort of like backers and donors of like right-leaning movements, is that if they often don't see the point in sinking money into something which is inherently unprofitable, like politics. Like, I don't know if you know, but there's an excellent thread, I'll have to find it somewhere, by Lomez, where he basically says that one of the reasons why the left do so well in America is because their funders basically just go,
they're happy to make a loss.
We're happy to make a loss. It's like, you can actually like make some cultural change. They're happy for the trade-off, whilst a lot of, like, you know, like Jeremy Hosking sinks money into like Lawrence Fox to like be a naughty school child. But like that's really it. That's an example of making a loss and like not really making the change that you want. But I think that, you know, but yeah, but just going back to like, you know, YouTube, like, who is there on the right that can actually finance such a movement and also be the face of a movement that is actually going to be sincerely, genuinely anti-establishment and not just like, oh, I'm going to bait a few trans people, I'm going to bait a few Muslims and then leave it at that?
Yeah. Do you think it is a conundrum? And I think that like by far the most important question about this upcoming election is that I'm not actually too interested in the dynamics of, oh my god, Bolsover has gone, like, I don't care about the like the sort of cephology of it. I'm not going to be watching John Curtis's analysis that evening, but what I am interested in is like what the fallout is on the right, and like how the right organizes itself in order to contend with this new movement, in order to avert Starmer from being in office, from being, as you put it, Starmageddon. One elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned is, of course, like the person of Nigel Farage. I mean, he is like by far one of the most charismatic figures in British politics. I suspect Reform would be doing much better if he was at the helm. Do you see him as the potential kingmaker in this sort of post 2024 sort of right wing
I think he would absolutely need to be on board, but I don't think that he would be the person to lead it on account of the fact that he seems to want to, and I don't blame him because Nigel's whole pitch was, we're going to leave the European Union, and I'm going to rally support to leave the European Union, and he's kind of done that. Like, he didn't promise to like save us from Starmageddon. He didn't promise to like save us from like demographic woes or like the sort of like Blairite regime, multiculturalism, whatever. He has like he's set out what he said to what he said he would do, and now he is very much in the mindset of wanting to be being a talking head on GB News and you know, like having
being Trump's right hand man.
But yeah, and like having going into having like sitting at his little table, having little makeup done, and being like, "What's happening today?" Like, I think that like that's a cozy gig, and like no one's blaming him. But I don't think that we can like place stock in like Farage like coming to save us, which is frustrating because he is charismatic. Yeah. He is like actually a good like public speaker. Like the Brexit Party rallies were fun. Yeah. Like
He's also the kind of person who, going back to the problem Evan was raised, well, both you and Evan have been raising. Is that he's also someone who people will vote for rather than vote for as an instrument to vote against someone.
Yes, although there would probably be a lot of people who would actually vote against him because I think that, was it Cummings
what I meant about that is that the people don't purely view Farage as an agent of chaos, they view him as an agent of change as well.
Yes, that's true.
Positive change.
It's much the same problem that Trump's going to have in the US, which is that people will vote for Trump and they will also literally go to the polls to vote against him.
That's very true.
Yes, did you see, I can't remember which state it was, but like Trump wasn't on the ballot and it was like none of the candidates won. None of the stated candidates was like the top, like got the most votes. Like there were people filming their ballots where they were writing in Donald Trump on every single like elected position.
Biden's gonna have this problem too in a big way. We were talking about this earlier, that people basically a low turnout, which I think we're gonna see in the US, which is, I think it was Michigan, 10% of the people in the Democratic primary basically were like none of the above, none of the candidates. It's gonna be very interesting. Because I think you're going to have, on one hand, you're going to have people come out in droves for Trump because they feel like he's had an election stolen from him. And you're also going to have a bunch of people refuse to show up for Biden because of Israel-Palestine. Anyway, aside.
It's an important one. But one final question to finish on, gents. And like maybe, I know Evan and I have spoken about this quite a lot, so maybe you can kick us off. Like, do you think that there is any hope to be found in the possibility that many of the people who, like, because you were saying like people have these sort of cushy gig in the media, it's so much easier to throw stones than it is to actually exact meaningful change. Do you think that if some of the more charismatic talking heads, like some on the right, some of the more charismatic people in the commentariat class, and that they are, again, as opposed to Farage, who's quite new to that game, the person who stands out most here is probably Douglas Murray. Do you think it's possible that things might get to such a bad state that we see people like Murray getting more involved in politics, and would that make him a meaningful difference?
Well, I mean, I asked Douglas Murray this question in Israel, and as much as I'm a great fan of Douglas, I think it's very difficult because anytime that I talk to any of these people, and I won't name names other than him because he's admitted it publicly, their biggest aspiration is basically to make enough money or get enough clout that they can move to America. That's the real thing. I can't think of a single person who's like, I want to get this massive platform so that, you know, the day after the Tories get decimated, I can jump in there or something. Everybody's literally thinking,
how do I get to America? Promised land.
Or like the south of France or something like that. Like, I do wonder, I don't know if this is like uncharacteristically black pill of me, but I do wonder, like, maybe if a good strategy would be to try to hoover up like 20 young Brits, if you had the money, send them all to DC, put them in like American think tanks, try to like come up with like a counteroffensive from abroad and then bring them back in. Because I just don't think that in this London thing, you know, as much as I'm a part of it and, you know, make my living in it, I think the greatest ambition is to be like the biggest show on GB News or to have a Substack that's bringing in six figures. And that's kind of where it ends. Whereas in America, it's always, and then what's next? And then what's next? You don't have this thing with Farage where he's like, I've done my thing and now I can go and sit in the makeup chair. It's always another step, another step, another step. What does this get me? So I wonder if that could be like injected into a couple 20-year-olds and then they could be flown back and parachuted into Westminster.
I can say without much detail that this has been tried a couple of times. Although, just on the point about how in Britain it seems that you set up a Substack that gives you some pocket money every month, and then that's it, game over. Congratulations, you defeated the woke. spoiler, not really, I think that as a political culture, we're constantly suspended in conversation and shooting the breeze. I think that even when people are even elected officials, they always use passive language. They always use the language of conversation. Well, we need to have a really tough conversation about this. You see it all the time in commentary with like politicians. It always results in we need to consider maybe possibly somewhat consider. Entertaining, we need to move in a direction. We need to start talking, or we need to consider talking.
We need to have a dialogue.
And it's like, can someone just end this? Can we have a little less conversation, a little more action, please?
Juan Donoso Cortez, who I brought up on this program before, called that the sort of the liberal cult of la clase discutidora, like just the discussing class,
which is
constantly going to defer.
Depoliticizes everything.
It depoliticizes everything. Let's just talk about it. And it's definitely, I like talking. I think that's evident to viewers who've watched the show regularly. But and my main temperament and is fundamentally sort of philosophical and contemplative and reflective. Yeah. I don't actually find politics doesn't give me that much satisfaction in itself. Nevertheless, finding ourselves in this incredibly urgent moment, which is genuinely where I think we are as a country. I just hope that because obviously there's nothing wrong with clout chasing in principle and trying to grow your Substack and trying to be influential, but there's nothing wrong with that. But does there come a point where that is just not enough to fulfill you anymore, and the prospect of going to the States or going to the south of France is not enough for you? I mean, when are people going to start to think, I actually really care about Britain and I do want to get involved?
If that's your disposition, I would recommend reading, I think it's The True Believer by Eric Hoffer.
I'm reading it right now. Rereading it.
Excellent. Yeah. But yes, at the moment we seem to be completely suspended in we've got plenty men of words, right? Yeah. Men of letters. We've got people who will happily write and pontificate, to what extent that's always high quality is debatable. Mm. But we have a lot of them. The fanatics are few and far between. Mm. And having any sort of political zeal or actually caring about politics, even within political circles, is considered weird.
Yeah.
It's I actually enjoy the militant processes, to borrow it from Alain de Bourdieu. I like the idea of, I was too young to vote in the referendum. Maybe that's a testament to how young I am compared to many people who actually care about politics as a consistent thing. But that was a time in history, and my first impression of politics where it was I saw democracy and politics completely unfiltered, and it was wonderful. It was exciting. Felt like that things were changing. Things were in motion. And now it's we're back to, square one. And I think that that is kind of ceremoniously, fittingly going to happen when, much in the same way in 2016, you had Trump and Brexit happening at the same time. And now in 2024, and, we've got the US and the UK, whilst the US is going to probably continue down the path and keep the populist revolution alive, here it seems to be slowly being squashed under the thumb of human rights lawyers and civil servants and such, saying, we need to be nicer to people. We need to have conversations. We mustn't be so divisive. Yeah. It's divisiveness is the essence of politics. If you do not like division, you should not be talking about or participating or anywhere near politics. You are robbing people of their freedom, of their determination, both in a political sense and also in a sense of actually wanting to do things. I'm not surprised that people are demoralized, because anytime anyone wants to do anything, it's kind of
gosh, you actually want to do something.
Yeah, gosh.
let us hope that we can perhaps in the coming years have more Caesar-like figures and fewer Catos. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us on Deprogrammed. Samuel Martin, Evan, thanks as ever. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below, or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.